Welcome, everybody. I'm Adam Angst, publisher of Tidbits and the Take Control series of ebooks. I'd like to welcome you to this Tidbits Presents event live on Google Hangouts on Air. Today, we're going to be talking about protecting your digital life, and you'll be hearing from two of our top security experts, Rich Mogul and Joe Kissel. Rich Mogul is a longtime security analyst, first for the consulting firm Gartner, and then as a principal of his own firm, Securosis. He also writes frequently about security in the Apple world, thanks to his security editor position at Tidbits and his contributions to Macworld. Rich spends much of his time traveling the globe, giving presentations at security conferences like DEF CON and to corporate clients. It's always fun hearing his stories about, you know, going to China with the, you know, whether you're going to have the throwaway iPhone this time or, you know, what they're going to do to you. Joe Kissel, of course, is one of the best-known names in the world of Apple writers thanks to his contributions to Tidbits, his articles for Macworld, and his numerous Take Control ebooks. Along with his Take Control of Mac OS X Passwords ebook, which is due for an update, Joe also penned the Mac Security Bible for Wiley in 2009. And I think one of the things that Joe ran into is security is a constantly changing field, and books are tough that way. They're harder to update, particularly that Wiley one, which was, what, 600 and some pages?
900 pages, thanks.
900 pages. Oh, that just hurts. I mean, for those of us who've done books before. If you're watching this video after the fact on YouTube, woo, there we go. If you're watching this video after the fact on YouTube, sit back and enjoy. Comments are welcome on the associated YouTube page, in the Google Plus post, or in the Tidbits article. If you're doing this presentation live, we are not doing a live chat on the Tidbits Presents page this time because Zoho chat is down this morning. Really quite frustrating. So instead, please leave comments on the Google Plus page on for the Hangout or in Twitter using the TB Presents hashtag. And I will pick those up and as we're going. We will be taking questions throughout, you know, recording them throughout, and then addressing them at the end this time. We're not gonna do them in the middle. I will be rephrasing questions as necessary, but please try to keep them concise. Finally, a disclaimer, as you're discovering, we're still learning what works best for Tidbits Presents, and Google Hangouts on Air is still quite new and changing regularly. If we have really bad technical difficulties, look at the Tidbits Presents page, reload it, and we'll tell you what's going on. So, without further ado, let's talk about Matt Honan. Matt Honan is a technology writer, writes for Gizmodo and Wired and other places. And what, about two and a half weeks ago now, he was hacked. He was hacked in a really big way, where the hackers took over his, first his Amazon account, and then his iCloud account, and then his Gmail account, sort of all with the goal of getting at his Twitter account. And it turns out this was the goal of the entire hack, was to take over his @Matt, M-A-T, Twitter account because it was only three letters. Somehow that made it exciting to the 19-year-old hacker who ended up basically doing all of this just to post racist and homophobic comments from @Matt. But he didn't just do that. He also did things like erase Matt Honan's iPhone and his iPad using iCloud's remote wipe. Those weren't too big of a deal, but he also remote wiped Honan's MacBook using the Find My Mac feature of iCloud. And that was a much bigger problem because, as it turns out, Honan did not have a backup. Which we'll talk a little bit about that. Yeah, it's just amazing at this time, this day and age. And at this point, he's actually worked through all of this stuff, and he's gotten a lot of his data back by paying $1,700 to DriveSavers, and so he's documented a lot of this, and so it's been really interesting to read all of the stuff about how the hacks happened, you know, the first going to Amazon, then going to iCloud, then going to Gmail and resetting passwords and all that. And it's been tremendously unsettling for us because, you know, we're kind of public figures in a small way, and we could be targeted too. Now, we'll talk more about Rich in particular here because, you know, let's face it, he's a security guy. But for those of us who are not security guys and don't think about, oh, gee, someone's after me at all times, it was still really troubling because Honan wasn't targeted for any good reason. He was targeted because he had a short Twitter username. And so if you can be targeted that randomly, or if you can be picked up because passwords were stolen from Dropbox or from Sony or something like that, the odds of this stuff happening are just getting higher and higher. And we got concerned. We wanted to talk more about this whole scenario and what people can do, how they can protect themselves. And so that's what we've been talking about internally, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So, Rich, just as a quick lead off, you're a security analyst. Are you like, do you have like a big, a bullseye in your back the whole time? I mean, what do you do with that sort of thing? Have you been targeted?
I don't know to the degree I have been targeted. So I know I've been targeted by friends doing research projects, and I actually managed to pass that one, so I was quite happy. I also have had some of my information released when some of my peers in the industry have been targeted. So a friend of mine, some people might have heard, Dan Kaminsky, he got hacked, and some of our private direct messages over Twitter, which are not actually private, of course, managed to get released as part of a big dump of public information, as well as I know they got a handle that I know they had all the emails that he and I had communicated. So I sort of assume that I'm a target, and I have to, and I am very cautious. I gotten, probes, of course, the random stuff, and I don't know how targeted those were. And so I think I'm safe, but at some point somebody will hack me. There's just no way to win, no way to, for your defenses to be up all the time.
Well, Joe, how about you? Have you or someone you know well ever been hacked?
Not in this way. I mean, not in the, steal, identity theft or break into your account kind of thing. I have had back in the days when I was running my own Xserve, a hacker did break in, used a PHP injection attack, and installed a spam bot on my Xserve and sent out, thousands of spam messages, which I was really, really unhappy about, especially having, written a book on spam and things like that. Luckily, I noticed this right away and shut it down and figured out what the problem was and fixed the security hole, and the host, the company that was co-locating my Xserve, gave me a sort of virtual pat on the back. It's like, well, I wish everybody responded as responsibly as you did, but I'm like, I still shouldn't have. I should have been smarter. I should have known how to avoid that. But this was one of those. This wasn't something that was targeted at me personally. This was a hackers looking for unprotected, for security holes on servers that they can use to send out spam. And I had a security hole and learned my lesson. So far, I have not had, as far as I am aware, any personal attacks. But like Rich, I do not in any way assume that I'm invulnerable. I take what I think are the smart measures, and every time a story like this happens, I go, I think I also better, do a little bit here and a little bit there, and I hopefully get a little bit smarter, and I don't assume it can never happen, but I try to stay ahead of the curve.
Well, personally, we've had a couple of, sort of server-based issues over the years just because we've run servers for so long. The closest we've ever had to a real identity hack wasn't all that significant, but our credit card number was stolen. It happens all the time these days. And this was a few years ago, but the amusing part was that Tanya handles all of our financial stuff. And so she was, kind of going through this stuff, and she's a charge on the credit card from Yahoo Personals. And so we had to, in fact, she calls up Yahoo and they, to figure out what the heck this is. And they are like, well, are you sure your husband didn't do that? She said, no, I think he's smart enough to know that if he was, trolling for dates, he should do it with a, anonymous credit card. So. But it was just, it was just the usual thing where the card number gets out and there's not much you can do other than cancel it, reverse the charge and move, change your number and move on. So, but I think the moral of the story, I mean, credit card numbers are out there, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit. When we looked at what Matt Honan had problems with, a great deal of it revolved around passwords on different sites, and resetting them. But for those of us who've been around for a long time and have hundreds and hundreds of accounts, you know, one of the pieces of advice that was promulgated years ago was to have different levels of security passwords, but to reuse them. This was, you know, before things like 1Password even existed. So you would say, well, this is my really secure password, and I'll use this for really secure stuff. And here's my really low security password. You know, I don't really care if someone reads the New York Times as me. So that password, if someone got out, wouldn't be a big deal. But it was reused. So reusing passwords across sites, Rich, is that a bad idea now?
It's always been a bad idea, but now it's it's very, very bad. And here's why. So, you know, we used to think of our passwords as somebody would guess a password and then maybe they could use that to get into our other sites. So as long as you had a good password and you could use it on multiple sites, you wouldn't have to worry about it. Well, what attackers are doing now is they will attack a site with weak security. They will dump the password file from that site. They will use techniques to extract the passwords. Even though they're supposed to be protected, a lot of sites don't follow best practices. And as a result, because a lot of web programmers and stuff, they just don't pay attention to how complex an issue that is or how difficult a problem that is to solve. And so then they get this whole list of passwords and this whole list of usernames. And then from there, it's just a matter of going around and checking other sites and trying those combinations until you can actually get into somebody's account. So password reuse is probably one of the biggest problems that we face in terms of protecting our digital life online.
So Joe, you've written obviously a lot about passwords. What is the best way, in your opinion, for people to avoid reusing passwords?
Well, you know,
remember. I mean, let's stipulate that to begin with. There's way too many to remember.
Yeah, I mean, we might get into the memory part later. There are certainly some passwords that you just have to memorize, and there's no two ways about it. But for passwords that you're going to enter on websites, you use a random password generator and some sort of secure storage mechanism. So 1Password is my favorite. It's what I use. LastPass, I mean, there's a whole bunch of password vault utilities that not only generate and store passwords, but let you enter them in web forms with a click or two or a keyboard shortcut. But I literally don't know 99% of my passwords. If somebody put a gun to my head, I could not tell you what most of my passwords are. I didn't even look at them when they were generated. I just, yeah, give me a password, fill it in, store it, and when I need to use it, I press my keyboard shortcut, the little, you know, bullets fill in, and that's it. I don't even, you know, I've never even seen most of my passwords. They're just, you know, 12 or 14 characters long, random, you know, letters and numbers and symbols. And so they're all different, and because I use a utility like that, I don't even have to think about them.
Rich, what do you use?
Yeah, I personally use 1Password. I started using that years ago. When I was a Windows user, I used RoboForm. I don't even know if that's still available. And so I've been using password tools like this for 7 or 8 years now. And again, just like Joe, don't have to remember them. And by the way, the best part of this isn't the not having to remember part. It is you get your nice little browser plugin. So you enter your password once, and you click that, and it logs you in all the sites, so you save all the typing.
Right.
In fact, I use 1Password for storing credit card stuff and that kind of secure data. But in fact, for most login passwords, I use LastPass because my experience has been that it's faster for automatically logging into sites. And I log into so many sites every day that having that, you know, in LastPass has been a real help for me. But I feel a little silly because I have 1Password installed. I will often end up saving my passwords in 1Password as well, because then they'll be there too. And they're protected by different, stronger passwords and things like that. So, well, this does raise another issue though, Rich. If everything is random and everything is in 1Password, what happens if, I don't want to jinx anything here, but what happens if you're hit by a bus and your wife has to deal with stuff for you?
You know, it's kind of funny you should ask, because I recently, like as in this week, I did this. And so let me get it back in the camera. This is one of two envelopes, and it's going to my attorney, our family attorney, who also my brother-in-law, so he's relatively trustworthy. And this is actually instructions on how to get into everything. So this includes the password to my computer, my main Mac, as well as my laptops that I use when I travel. It includes instructions how to get to 1Password, instructions, my password for 1Password. It's the only place on the face of the earth that's written down. It has all the other passwords, the ones that I have memorized. So there's some like my iCloud password, my iTunes password, and some bank passwords that aren't in 1Password. Those are all written down now. And then it also has instructions on how to get to things I think she will care about. So how do you get to photos? Because she doesn't use my Mac. She uses iPhoto on hers, but I have all the pictures in Aperture, and she doesn't know where that is or where that library is. It has instructions for dealing with old emails, archived emails from when we first started dating, kind of memory stuff that she might want. And then it has the who to call to get help with stuff. And so a friend of all of ours, Chris Pepper, I go, if it's a Mac issue, call Chris. If it's a security issue, call one of my work partners. They know hackers who can break into anything of mine with the information that's in here and with our permission. And so that's the fail-safe plan, and that's going to be not in our house. It'll be locked up wherever our lawyer keeps all sorts of his legal documents.
That sounds like an extremely good thing to do, and I should do something very similar. We have certain things written down in sort of a shared secure location, but I don't think we have anything quite so comprehensive as that, which would be useful.
It's only a page and a half. And by the way I wrote it, because I'm the paranoid security guy, I wrote it on my iPad because that's the most secure device I have. I printed it out on my printer, and then I deleted the file off of my iPad. What you don't want is you don't want this sitting around on your Mac, and maybe it's in your cache file or something like that. So if you have a device you can do that from, do it. If not, well, okay, just take the risk.
We should do a Tidbits article where we give people the form. Any of it. We'll move on.
Oh.
It seems like password reset features are one of these really big weak links, because let's face it, you know, something goes wrong, you forget the password, you don't have your password utility with you, you're on some other machine, you're on an iOS device, you need to reset a password. And reset utilities or reset features are intentional backdoors. That's the whole goal of them, is to let you in if you don't know the password. We can't control how the different sites enable us to reset lost passwords. But are there parts of the, what's the most important part of the entire password reset chain that we can control?
I'll let Rich answer this first.
So the thing is there's basically two styles or three styles of these password resets. And I don't criticize the companies and the sites that use these. We use it on ours because there's really just no other good way to solve the problem. So the first is you submit a reset request, and it goes to your primary email you use to register for the site, and then that usually has a link to reset your password. There's not much you can do with that. You can't really change that. The one thing is you want to be careful of protecting your primary email account, because if somebody gets to that,
right,
they can run around and reset every password to everything you have,
right,
if there's no additional security. So that's the biggest one, protect that email account. The second style will ask security questions, mother's maiden name, last four digits of your social security number, those sorts of things. That's the one you can influence. So the problem with like Matt Honan was he used information that somebody could guess. We've seen this when Sarah Palin's Hotmail account got hacked. That was because they did the research and the social engineering to get the information to be able to answer those questions. Your first elementary school, the names of your first pet or your current pet. The way I resolve that is I have a random phrase, and I use that for every single one of those questions. So if it asks me my first pet, I give it that answer. If it asks me my mother's maiden name, I give it the same answer. Now, to a certain degree, it reduces security because if that gets out, they can get access to everything. And that is a risk because depending on how they store that information on their site, but I have accepted that level of risk at this point in time. And knowing also that I can, kind of bounce around and reset those. And I actually use a few. I don't just use one. But I did this yesterday. I had to reset a password. It asked me the question. I put in the name of my first pet. That was wrong. I put in the name of this answer. That was correct. And I was able to do my reset. And then the last thing they do is they may send something to your phone or to a secondary email account. And again, for those, be really careful with your email account security. Preferably don't use an account where somebody can do a password reset that easily. So for me, my work account is like that. You can't password reset my work account. You have to walk into my house, log on to that server, and that's the only way to do it. There's other email providers sometimes where it's a more manual process. Or they call your phone, and of course, as long as you enter that, if you have that, just enter that info. Give them your phone number for that.
So I wonder if there are, if, you know, we, that would be something that we should actually figure out, which is which email providers kind of make password resets difficult, because it might be the sort of thing where you actually create an account just to handle that, and because it would be more difficult than whatever you use, you know, if you use iCloud or Gmail or, you know, one of the more standard email providers that are relatively easy to reset.
Yeah, I think I'd certainly like to know that.
Me too. You know, I thought about that after we had our prep call to put this together, and unfortunately, I didn't have time because I was on airplanes flying around to talk to security companies.
And I should just say, you know, if you do what Rich suggests, which I endorse, I mean, when you're asked a security question, lie, because, I mean, you know, you're only lying to a computer. You know, the whole purpose is to validate who you are. So the only thing that counts is, do you know the answer, not is the answer true. But if you make up some word or phrase or string of random, you know, characters as your answer to security questions, be sure you put that in 1Password or LastPass or, you know, your little envelope for your wife or whatever, because you're going to forget that, or your wife won't know it, or, you know, something, you know, if your wife really has to get into that account and she's asked your security questions and she knows your mother's maiden name, but she doesn't know your magical phrase, then that could be a problem. So
one thing that I think we should talk about briefly is one of the reasons why Rich and Joe are suggesting coming up with almost a second password to answer all these security questions for is the questions themselves are often tricky. You know, they're, you know, who was your best friend growing up? Well, for a lot of people, that's not a really set, solid answer. You might have had a different best friend in elementary school and in high school. Or, you know, who was your favorite teacher? You know, even things like, you know, what was your first job? Well, you know, maybe it was the first job after college. Maybe it was mowing lawns. You know, you don't know the answers to these things necessarily. And so if you do try to answer them directly, at least aim for the ones which have solid fixed answers which can't be confused, you know your father's middle name or something. But that said, the other concern that we've had with these is you don't really know when and where you'll be asked. So I would actually recommend against making it a random password, you know, 17 digits and characters and letters, because if you're asked that on the phone, you may have a very hard time relating it. So, you know, a phrase of, you know, horse battery staples or something like that to reference the XKCD comic on passwords would be a better password in that case, because it's something that you could say over the phone or type in very easily.
Yeah, if you can't speak it or remember it, and it's in one of those kinds of fields, you're kind of in trouble. So, yeah, absolutely. Mine is something that it's very easy for me to remember. It's long enough, you know, relatively long, but not, you know, it'll still fit on all of those different sites. I don't have to cut off letters because I planned poorly, those sorts of things.
Yeah. Okay, let's step back for a moment and talk about what personal information is readily available about us online. Joe, I mean, our names are obviously out there, but was it a bad idea for me to use Adam Angst as my username everywhere?
Well, you know, so okay, I use Joe Kissel as my username absolutely everywhere, and from my point of view, at this point, that's just a lost cause. I actually like the fact that I am identified by my actual name everywhere, because I like that level of transparency. I never really comprehended or participated in this whole, you know, alias thing. Like, you know, you have this special username by which you are known, you know, on, you know, you're Warlock on the internet. And we just watched Die Hard 4 last night. So I like being myself, and I like people being able to find me. So whether it's your you know, your actual name or some version of your name, or it's you know, your email address, I sort of take for granted that's out there. And since it is out there, and since really anybody, that would be the first thing anybody guessed anyway, that there's really, you know, sort of no point in trying to disguise that. I wish that there were a better system than usernames and passwords. It's sort of, you know, sort of the best we have generally right now. But I sort of give that up as a lost cause. At the same time, though, when I, you know, back to, you know, you're mentioning security questions like your mother's maiden name or your father's middle name or your first pet's name or where you went to an elementary school. I mean, come on. Anybody can figure that out for anybody. Look, you know, if you read, you know, interesting thing of the day, like I have hundreds of articles that I've written. I've mentioned, you know, facts about myself and my family and my history and, you know, look at anybody's Facebook page, do a Google search. I mean, you can find out these things pretty easily. So it's almost not worth trying to hide those facts because they're too easily discoverable. The only sensible thing to do is to not use the real answers when you're asked for those questions.
Well, Facebook in particular would seem to be trouble because their entire goal is to get you to share information, link to people you're related to. So, gee, there's all these relatives with this other name. I wonder if that's the, you know, his mother's maiden right. name. And just, you know, again, sharing information as widely as possible, it seems almost difficult to prevent that from getting out. But Rich, what about postal addresses and phone numbers? I mean, those are not the sort of thing that generally show up on Facebook, but are they ever used for identification purposes, and how easy are they to find?
Yeah, I mean, we do see those sometimes used for identification and historical addresses in some yeah. kinds of systems, and they are ridiculously easy to find, even if you have an unlisted phone number. There's so many techniques to get those, and some of them really, really easy. Like if you've bought a house or done anything that involved a public, at least in the United States, if you've done anything with like your local government, all that information gets exposed. Paying your taxes can expose your information.
So don't think that's... Sorry.
Wait, don't you live in France?
That means I get to pay taxes to two countries.
And one, let's see, 30%, 40%. So you have 30% of your income left, if I do my math. So anyway, back to the topic at hand. Yeah, all that's wildly public and very easy to find with. Now, it may be hard for you to find, and I would actually say encourage, go try and hack yourself. See how much information you can get up.
Well, one of the main ways that Matt Honan was hacked involved his credit card number, which you know, there was something about how the hacker was able to call Amazon and add a credit card number to Honan's account and then use that credit card number to log in to look at other ones. Aren't parts of credit card numbers essentially public, Rich?
The last four and the first four are not required to be secure.
Okay.
And that's per the this thing called the Payment Card Industry Data Security Standard. So you'll notice actually now, even when you go to a restaurant and you swipe your card, it always dots out everything usually except the last four. But that's considered non-sensitive, and which means that it's you can find that in lots of different places. Remember, if somebody hacks a site and they get your username and your password, there maybe they'll have the last four of your credit card number too. I mean, you just don't know.
Right. And then there was something with Apple was allowing the last four of the credit card number to be part of the verification along with postal address.
Yeah, and that was for if somebody went to do a verbal password reset. So their automated system just asked the normal questions, that was fine. But if you called into Apple support, which they have to do because they deal with a lot of people who wouldn't be able to find even a password reset button, then you were able to use the last four of the credit card you used to sign up with your account. Now, it sounds like there were some other failures on their side, like their process was normally, not get to the point where just knowing that would have been enough, but Amazon would actually show those last four as part of some of their internal things when you were working, trying to check your accounts. I don't know the details of it. And that's how the guy who hacked Matt Honan got those four. Okay. Then he used those with Apple. So it's this chaining because your information is in so many different places, protected to so many different levels, that all they have to do is find the weak spot here and the weak spot here and piece your life together.
Okay, well, the real problem, as we were saying at the top of the show, the real problem that Matt Honan had when his iCloud account was hacked was not so much they took it over, but that the guys who did so decided to remote wipe his MacBook to make it harder for him to regain control of his Twitter account. And he... didn't have a backup of his data. Joe, as the author of Take Control of Backing Up Your Mac, would you care to express some astonishment that someone with Matt Honan's experience and in his position wouldn't have turned on Time Machine? Sorry, couldn't resist the softball.
I hereby express astonishment. When I first wrote about backups in like 2003 or something, like my biggest job in writing about this was to convince people that backups were actually necessary and important. So I don't have to do that anymore. People know, I think most people know, that it's important, why it's important. And now the question is more, you know, what's the best way to do it? Backing up your Mac could require as much effort as going out and spending $100 on a hard drive to plug in and then clicking a button. Or, alternatively, it could require as much effort as paying some company like CrashPlan $5 a month, installing some software, and clicking a button.
Mm.
If someone does not have, you know... I'm sure there are some people out there who legitimately cannot afford $5 a month or, you know, a one-time $100 purchase. And sorry. But other than that, I really have very little sympathy for people who do not bother to actually plug in the thing and click the button. It's really, really easy to create at least a basic backup. I mean, of course, there are lots of ways of backing up your Mac and lots of different things you could do. But I mean, for a simple, just, I got to get this thing backed up, you plug in a cable, you click a button. Really, it's that simple. So anyone who hasn't at least done that much, please go do it right now. Stop watching us. Go get a hard drive. Plug it in, click the button.
This will be recorded. You can stop now and, you know,
that's right. Come back later.
Literally
back up your Mac right this minute.
And this is a little hard too. Like, your friends and family, go out to them. And I don't know about you guys. I struggle with this all the time. I have family members. I have friends. They have digital photos of children and all of these important memories and everything else. And they don't do their backups. And it's so easy. Even on Windows, it's pretty easy these days. It's a little harder than a Mac because you don't have Time Machine. You plug it in and you click buttons, or you pay, you know, you sign up for CrashPlan, and people complain, I don't want to spend $100 on that. I'm like, you spent $100 on beer last weekend. You cannot tell me, or last month, let's be realistic, that you can't afford to sign up for an unlimited data storage plan that you literally never have to look at after you install.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, you buy car insurance, you buy, you know, homeowner's insurance or renter's insurance, how much would it cost you in your time, in effort, in agony to recover all this stuff? And in the case of, you know, Matt Honan, it wasn't just his time and money, it was like his baby pictures of his daughter. I mean, you know, that no amount of money can replace those things. Now, I do want to say, because, you know, I feel a lot of gratitude toward Matt. I mean, I'm very, very sorry that he had to suffer all this. But I am very grateful that he wrote about it so openly and so extensively. I mean, in a way, he kind of took a bullet for all of us.
Yeah.
And I know that he didn't volunteer for this. But because he endured all this and because he wrote, you know, and has done all these interviews and articles and things so thoroughly about it, his misfortune has helped all of us, has helped me to be more secure. And I hope that it, you know, it's by provoking this conversation, it's helping many people to be more secure. So I just want to sort of express to him, although I, you know, shame on you for not backing up, thank you for being the one to go through this and for writing about it, because this has helped everyone.
I do want to criticize him, though, because Matt has said he's not going to pursue this guy who did this to him legally, and that's just going to encourage this to happen again. This is no different than somebody literally trying to burn your house down, in my mind. I mean, again, we call this digital life because this is more than just an account, and it's more than an email, and it's more than a credit card. His entire digital life, this guy tried to destroy it just so he could get access to his Twitter account. pictures of his kids, his financial, I mean, everything. You know, who knows what else was on there, you know, tax returns or whatever else it was. Boy, if this ever happens to you, you know, don't get suckered in by, oh, it's just an innocent kid hacker. Those days have been over for over a decade. You need to pursue these guys. You need to go in law enforcement, and that kid should go to court and at least be on some sort of monitoring, if not jail time, because it is that serious.
I don't necessarily disagree with that, but the question I want to ask to follow that up is, suppose Matt or someone who encounters a similar situation goes to law enforcement, is this going to then make them even more of a target? Are there going to be repercussions? Are other hackers going to say, well, you think that was bad, wait till, you know, I mean, is there a downside to that? Or is there, I mean, is this like, you know, informing on the mafia or something? Is this the sort of thing where you really want to do the right thing, but there are, you know, consequences?
Well, first of all, I think there's, for most of our listeners, no, there wouldn't be additional consequences because they're not going to be blogging on one of the biggest tech sites in the world. For someone like Matt, I think that I don't really care. You're saying, if I was hacked, I would pursue aggressively, and maybe that makes me more of a target. So I would just be more, you know, be more careful with my security. If you are in the right, in other words, if somebody, you know, there's one thing like in a, you know, the WikiLeaks stuff or those sorts of things where you get anonymous after you because you say something that can be misconstrued. But this is a case where this guy went and attacked him and just tried to destroy his life. You know, I think even, you know, the recreational hackers can recognize that difference, the juveniles. And I think that the real bad guys don't care because they're out to make money and they don't do this anyway.
Yeah. It feels to me like there's a bit of a split between the kinds of hacking that goes on, that what was almost more unsettling about Matt Honan's hack was that it was pure vandalism, that at least with the criminals, you know why they're doing it. You know, they're doing it to get money. And so it's at least rational. It's not this almost Clockwork Orange, you know, let's see if we can go and hurt people kind of attitude that really, you know, there's a sort of a bad neighborhood aspect to it that worries me. But that still seems unusual. And I guess, Rich, I'd wonder a little bit more, are there people who should worry more or less than others?
Absolutely. Now, there's sort of, there's different kinds of neighborhoods that you live in online. And we used to be able to classify that more clearly. If you stayed out of a porn and gambling site, you weren't going to get malware on your Mac. And if you, you know, avoided these other areas, the reality is that there's a lot of opportunities, a lot of neighborhoods that are more dangerous because of the anonymity of the internet. So let me give you examples. Obviously, all of us are targets because we're public figures. I am a bigger target than you guys because I focus more on security. Joe would be next because he wrote a security book, silly boy. And then Adam at the bottom of the list because you're just so nice. So that's one degree. If you have a profile on the internet. So one of the things that like I worry about is, you know, I write things that are critical of LulzSec and Anonymous and hacking groups at times. And I write those in very public ways. And I just accept the fact that there's a risk that comes with that. And odds are at some point I'll be hacked, and I try and layer my defenses. So even if somebody tries to, you know, hurt me, there's walls to how far they can damage me, such as I have a spare hard drive with family photos. I update monthly. I keep it my in-laws, you know, offline. There's no way to get to that. The second is if you do things like everybody is in some sort of a digital community. You might be on, you know, Pinterest or Pinboard or whatever it is. You might be on Facebook. You might be on whatever. If you say things to upset others, which we're all going to do, then that could potentially invite attack. I think people that really should watch out, like if you're younger, high school, college age, where there's a lot of emotions and what in my mountain rescue days we called were testosterone, you are more likely to trigger somebody, you know, potentially going at you. Because of the emotions that are involved and the lack of self-control at that particular age. No offense, don't hack me. So that's an area to be careful. If you get into debates with trolls online, you know, people will just come after you these days. And it may not be a hacker. It could just be someone who, you know, has decided that they don't like you anymore. So I'm not saying everywhere is dangerous. Yes, there's a degree of danger everywhere. What I am saying is, just as you can have awareness walking down the street, you can have an awareness online. And you probably know if you participate in these communities or engage in activities online that might be more likely to invite some sort of an attack. That makes sense?
So, Joe, you know, and I don't know that, I mean, this hasn't happened to any of us, so it's a little hard to say, you know, for sure. But are there steps that you would recommend someone would try to go through if they do find themselves being hacked?
Well, you know, it depends on what the nature of the hack is. I mean, if you turn on your Mac someday and it says, you know, nothing, you know, I've just been erased, then that you're what you have to do next would be different than if just your Twitter account were hacked into. To, you know, what Rich was talking about earlier, I think one of the very first things I would do would be to make sure my email accounts are secure. And by make sure they're secure, I mean go in and change all the passwords just in case. Make sure that I still can, you know, log into all of my email accounts. And as soon as I have verified that I can, change the passwords. And if I can't, then immediately contact the provider and you know, start to get that unhacked. Because the fact that your email is often used as a way to reset passwords is potentially a weak link, and that is the first thing to plug up. Obviously, this is going to be a time at which you start thinking, now, you know, did I use this password anyplace else? And you know, you might have to go through a sort of long series of changing your passwords. But each case is different. I mean, the fact that, you know, one account was hacked or got access to does not necessarily imply that others were. But as this experience has shown us, certain things are extra vulnerable. So if somebody does get access to your iCloud account, that not only gives them access to your email, but that lets them, you know, control your computers remotely and erase them remotely and do really bad.
Let me interrupt for just a second, because that's something I want to touch on. Find My Mac is a new feature. This is, you know, this is not something we've had. We had it for the iPhone, you know, and iOS devices for a while. But what do you recommend with Find My Mac? I mean, should people be turning this on? Is it different with laptops versus desktops?
Well, I have always recommended that you do turn it on. And there have been lots of cases where, you know, iOS devices and even laptops, because there's, you know, especially, you know, like a MacBook Air, it's so easy to pick up and steal, doesn't have a security slot. There have been lots of cases where Macs have been found and recovered with this feature that, I think for many people that's a worthwhile risk. It's murkier with desktops. I mean, if your desktop is in a location that is physically fairly secure, hard for people to get at, there's not a very good argument for using Find My Mac. You know where it is. And if someone has you know, broken into your home or office and stolen your Mac, yeah, it's true that having that on could help the police to locate it, but then again, you might have bigger problems.
Yeah, right.
So for me, I think it's still quite compelling to use on laptops, although, you know, I also recommend other things like using File Vault to encrypt your laptop and having backups. So, you know, I have a laptop right here that is encrypted with File Vault and is backed up and does have Find My Mac turned on. So if the very worst thing happened and, you know, it got wiped, my insurance would cover that. I could go buy a new laptop and I would restore from a backup, end of story. So it would be a hassle, but, you know, ultimately no harm done. With a desktop, you know, the problem is if you only have one computer or if all of your computers get wiped, then you have no tools with which you can, you know, reestablish all of your accounts and things. So, I would say, you know, it's not clear that everyone needs to use this for desktops. And if you're not sure that you do, you probably don't. But for laptops, I still would.
All right. Well, thank you both. That's pretty much what we had scheduled to talk about. We do have a couple of questions that have come in via Google Plus and our Twitter. So let's basically, first of all, thank you both for joining me, and we'll move on to the questions. This will be the part that if people want to step out, we're going to be just going over other stuff. So first question is, what's the best password utility that works for both Macs and iOS devices? Joe, have a thought on that?
Well, I mean, you know, I use 1Password everywhere. There are versions for iOS. There are versions for Windows, Mac. I think for Android, too, although I don't have an Android device, so I've never had to really explore that. LastPass, which you, Adam, use, also has versions for a bunch of different platforms. And, I mean, if you just go on to the iOS App Store and do a search, you'll probably find a dozen others. I mean, there are actually lots of password utilities that work on multiple platforms. I use 1Password partly because, inertia. I mean, I've used it for years, and so it has always worked for me, and so I've continued. But also because every time I try something else out, I kind of go, it just doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't have some feature that I have become accustomed to, or it doesn't work the way I prefer. And so for me, that's best. I mean, I've used LastPass too. It's great. If that's what you prefer, more power to you. But it's, for me, it's not so much a matter of recommending a particular program. It's find something that works on all the devices you use and lets you, you know, enter, you know, not have to re-enter your password separately on each different device, and then just stick with it.
So, Rich, perhaps there have been presentations about this at DEF CON or the like. T. Smythe asks, how secure really are 1Password and these other tools?
They're pretty good. So I haven't looked at 1Pass, or LastPass, sorry. 1Password has been looked at. There was one kind of iOS flaw that was found at one point that would have been really hard to exploit, and those guys fixed it. So they take it very seriously. Most security people I know use it, and it does seem to be pretty secure. I mean, look, if you lose your 1Password, you're hosed. But I even synchronize my stuff over Dropbox, and I'm fully comfortable with it because they are pretty transparent about how they do their encryption. And it's a good setup, and I think they're very secure. I have not looked at LastPass, so they may be just as secure. I just can't speak from experience.
Sure. I think that one of the things that's interesting about this entire situation is we talk a lot about secure passwords, you know, having these passwords that are hard to type and will be entered for us. But there's two problems with that. One is you're at the mercy of your utility, and one of the things I've been discovering is more and more in iOS, you can't get to those passwords easily. You know, if you need, it may be a website password on the Mac that 1Password can handle just fine, but if it's an app password on iOS, that's a lot harder to deal with. And so, I'm curious if you have any thoughts about how you deal with, you know, places where those password utilities don't work, or, you know, another one, if you have to log into Unix machines and you can't type, you know, 1Password's not going to type it into terminal for you as you SSH in. How do you deal with those sort of situations?
Well, I could tell you how I deal with that, but that would be revealing a security secret. I've actually been thinking about this question a lot lately because, I have an Apple TV. And so just like a couple of days ago, so we have some guests visiting and we were out of town and they were trying to use our Apple TV to watch Netflix. But for unknown reasons, the Apple TV decided to log me out of my Netflix account. So when I came back, I'm like, well, I'll just log back in. And of course, my Netflix password was one of these, you know, long, complex ones. And, you know, trying to enter a password on an Apple TV, oh, come with a little remote. I mean, yeah, if you have one of the apps, you can use your iPhone keyboard. But, I mean, you know, like, up, over, 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 and then you got to go up and you choose a capital letter, and it's, oh man, and there are sort of a lot of places like that. Like, it's harder to enter a password on an iPhone than on a Mac, and it's harder to enter a password on an Apple TV than on an iPhone, and so I've been trying to I've been sort of trying to think through this. Okay, now what is the right thing to do here? You know, like, for example, maybe for any password that needs to be entered on an Apple TV, I make it longer, but only use lowercase letters, so I don't have to keep switching screens. You know, now I'm at the capital letter screen, now I'm at the number screen. Or maybe for passwords that have to be entered manually on an iPhone, I choose pronounceable passwords, so that because, you know, those things, like you say, app passwords, things that you can't use the utility to enter for you automatically. If you at least make them pronounceable, then you're not having to like, okay, it was 3G, okay, now I got to switch back and enter those, and wait, I got to go back to my password utility. What were the next three characters? Yeah. You know, at least if you, you know, you can sort of sacrifice a short password for a pronounceable password or something, you know, make other compromises that make it a little bit easier to handle. But I mean, the thing is, because of sandboxing on iOS devices, there just isn't a way for password utilities to, you know, put things in all the different places that you might want to have them. And it's one of those trade-offs. You know, you have sandboxing to make you more secure, but the cost of security is more hassle.
Yeah. Rich, any thoughts about that? Do you run into the same thing?
Yeah. I mean, of course we all run into it. I've managed that with, those passwords, sometimes those will be the ones that I memorize. And I might still put them in 1Password, by the way, but it's something that I can type in, because you can still store manual passwords in there. So it's pretty random, but it's not overly long, and I can still kind of enter it in. And of course, I use the remote app on my iPhone for my Apple TV to avoid the situation that Joe is in. But, yeah.
The thing that I was actually just putting some thought into this as well, and because of the password that you have to enter more than any other password is your Apple ID password, of course. And if you change that on Apple, I don't know if you guys have run into this, they now require that it have an uppercase letter and it's an uppercase letter, at least one number, and no three characters can be repeated, which starts to force you into certain patterns for basically typing something easily. And one of the basic rules I came up with, and when I'm trying to figure out my new password for this, was to say that I only want to switch keyboards once. So, you know, letters at first, and then move to punctuation and numbers. And not go back. Because once you start having to flip back and forth, that's when it gets easy to make mistakes and cause that kind of problem. And you can still come up with some pretty secure passwords that way, but you want to think a little bit about something so it's not too hard to type.
That's actually a great idea. I'm going to copy that.
Okay, we'll put together all these little things later. Alan Forkosh asks, Rich, I don't know if you've seen this or not, Dan Gooden apparently did an article on Ars Techno this week about the state of password hacking. Have you read that?
So I saw the article. I read the line. I put it in Instapaper, and it's still sitting in Instapaper, ready for me to read. I've been traveling. I think the summary of it was about how people break into sites, and then they reverse engineer the stored files based on the hashes, and then you can use that to go to other sites with the reuse issue. So that's my understanding, I think, of what the basis is. And as we talked about in the beginning, that's why you want to use these tools and use a password management tool.
Okay. And then this also may, I wonder if this has come up at DEF CON or the like. Mark MTZ asks, how would you rate Gmail's two-factor authentication? Is it secure, and is it worth the effort?
Well, I mean, anytime you can use two-factor, I think it's secure and worth the effort. You know, and it depends on what kind of two-factor. Your banks actually play a game. They are legally required to do two-factor. And so what they do is they do this weird thing where they figure out what computer you're on by doing a profile of your computer. And then they'll ask you for, like, your PIN code if you're not from that registered computer. And that's actually a poor man's two-factor I don't like. The real good one is that people will either send a text message to your phone that you enter in, or if you actually have the little Joe, were you saying you've got one of the little?
Yeah.
There we go. You have to talk or they can't see you on video.
Oh,
Joe.
Sorry. Sorry.
Say something.
Doesn't make any noise. So this is an RSA.
Wait, hold that closer. I can't see the number.
Well, it doesn't matter because it'll change in 30 seconds. So it's this is just it generates a new number every 30 seconds, a 6-digit number. And so when I log into my bank account, I have to give my not just my username and my password, but also the value of this at this particular moment. So I have a couple of these, but these are used. I mean, a lot of banks use these. PayPal uses these. A lot of financial services use them. And every couple of years, they'll send me a new one, you know, because whatever, the battery will die or something. But I had a situation where I had to reset my password, or there was some problem with my account, and so I had to get on the phone with my bank, and they make me read them off the number every 30 seconds for like 2 minutes. I don't know all the details of how it generates these and how they're validated, but it's a one-way sort of thing where you can't go back.
Okay. Rich, I know you have to head out at 1, so I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us. Joe, we have one more question I'd like to go through with you, but again, thank you, Rich, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, guys. Sorry to run off, and everyone have a great day.
Thanks. Bye.
So Joe, David Cuddy asks, one's Apple ID is becoming increasingly important, what with, iTunes, iCloud, the Apple Store, everything. And Matt Honan was partly hacked by the bad guy deducing his Mobile Me account. It was matthonan@me.com, I believe, thus gaining access to his Apple ID. Do you recommend changing your Apple ID from one's primary email address to something obscure, such as an email address never used for anything else? And is that possible or practical or even possible?
You can change. Yes and no. So like, if you have something at me.com, you can add a secondary address, but you can't change that address. So if my initials, jwk@me.com, I've had that forever. It's in my books, so that's public information. That's not a secret. jwk@me.com. You heard it here. I can add aliases to that, and I can add additional IDs, but I can't change that. I could stop using that account altogether and get a brand new Apple ID, but by getting an Apple ID, even if I use a completely different email address as my Apple ID, which of course you can do, they're still going to ask you for come up with a me.com address. You have to have one of those also if you're going to use it for iCloud. So I think as I was saying before, most of my usernames are Joe Kissel at wherever, Joe Kissel, at Joe Kissel for Twitter and so on. So I consider that just sort of, a lost cause. My email addresses are out there. My name is out there. And I don't think we can, I don't think it's really worth the effort to try to disguise that, frankly.
Well, it sounds like what we're running into with Apple IDs more and more is that it falls into put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket.
Yeah, yeah.
For better or worse. We don't have a choice. All our eggs are in that basket. That, right. That Apple ID can even log into our Macs now.
Right. Use a great password. Answer the security questions with, following the guidelines we gave earlier, and back up. Because no matter how smart you are, somebody is going to be smarter than you. I don't assume that I'm the smartest person on the planet. Someone could figure out how to get into my accounts, but I have lots of backups.
Well, I think that's probably where we should cut this, because that is the best advice, good passwords and back up. Be careful out there, folks. Thank you all for coming to this Tidbits Presents Protecting Your Digital Life. We had about 65 people watching the entire time, which was great. And this will be recorded on YouTube so other people can come in later. Thank you again, and please leave us comments. Let us know what you thought. Thanks, guys.